Okay.
7 o'clock central. welcome. I just wanted to introduce myself. My name is Robert Grandia. Me and my wife, Shannon, who's also on the call, we are adult regional coordinators for the TS Alliance. And I want to let you know that this is a coping call, and we actually are going to record it, and we'll record the doctor's part, and hopefully any good questions, we can always put it on the website, and it'll always be there. So let me introduce our speaker. Ms. Patricia Gibson, MSSWDHL-ACSW, is an associate professor in the Department of Neurology at Wake Forest University School of Medicine, where she provides individual, group, and family counseling and is actively involved in medical student, nursing, patient, and community education. She also serves as director of the Epilepsy Information Service, a nationwide telephone information line for patients and their families, members, in operation since 1979. Ms. Gibson received her Master's of Science in Social Work degree from the University of Tennessee. In 2012, she was awarded an honorary doctorate in from Queens University in Charlotte, North Carolina. Ms. Gibson has organized and conducted numerous state, regional, and more than 40 national and international conferences on epilepsy. She set up the Epilepsy Medication Fund for the state of North Carolina in 1987 and conducts numerous fundraisers for this fund. She has received national and international awards for her work to improve the care of those with epilepsy. She presently serves as the volunteer executive director of the Epilepsy Foundation of North Carolina. And with that, I introduce Ms. Patricia Gibson.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here with you. I would very much like this to be an interactive conversation.
That'd be awesome.
And I would like to hear from some of those who are in the audience to find out what particular issues you would like to talk about in regard to coping. If someone would tell me some of the issues or situations that have come up where they have had to come up with some coping skills. If no one starts, Dina, you tell me about some situation you've dealt with.
Anybody?
Yeah, I like to chime in and say I think it's hard. I think one of the hardest things with coping skills for me personally is twofold, one with marital relationships and also the other with my employer. In that, at the heat of the moment, not breaking down and being caught in confusion because of impulsivity and not saying the wrong thing at any given time.
Coping is tough, and I'll tell you, those marital relationships are the toughest of all. Interpersonal relationships, I think, can be very difficult. And when we talk about coping, we're just sort of referring to, you know, consciously trying to solve some personal or interpersonal problem with the goal to sort of master, minimize, or tolerate stress or conflict. And this is something every single person ends up having to deal with if you're in this life. And the coping mechanisms are commonly called coping strategies or coping skills. And strategies that reduce stress and other strategies may be even maladaptive and may create more problems. For instance, someone who escapes or copes with their problem by drug use or alcohol use, that usually is not a helpful coping strategy and may end up in the long run creating much more stress. But most of the time when we're talking about coping strategies, we're referring to those that are more of the adaptive coping strategies. And a lot of how effective they are really depends on the type of stress, the individual, and the circumstances. And coping responses are actually partly controlled by personality. There are some people that come into this world better equipped for dealing with stress than other people. They are different chemically, different physically in how they're able to cope with stress. And you can see this at a very young age. There are some kids that everything just rolls off their back and they don't seem to, you know, have a problem with anything. And then there are other kids that come into this world much more sensitive than other people. And that's just another trait, just like what color of hair you have, what color of eyes. You know, some people are better equipped at coping with stress than other people. So it's partly decided by the social environment, and particularly the nature of the stressful environment. Putting someone in Afghanistan presents a big, much different problem, that social environment, one in which nobody's been, you know, is equipped to find themselves in that situation. And that makes a big difference in how effective coping strategies are. So there's hundreds of different coping strategies. And psychologists tend to group them. One category is appraisal-focused, which is directed at challenging personal assumptions. It's how you perceive that situation, how you appraise that situation. And, you know, looking at this and saying, no, wait a minute, did that person really mean that or not? You know, maybe he was having a bad day. Maybe it wasn't you. Maybe this person, you know, you have to look at where they're really coming from. We don't know how they feel or what they really meant by what they said. And that's one way of looking at things, you know, coping and looking at things cognitively and appraising it differently. And I can tell you that, you know, we all make mistakes in that regard. We all make assumptions about people as to what they're thinking or what they meant. And a lot of times we're wrong. We don't always know what someone is thinking. They may have a stomach ache and you not know it. And that's what their problem is. You just, you know, it's really realizing that you don't have the full picture of what this person is feeling or going through or whatever. Then there's the problem-focused technique, which just looks at, okay, what's the problem and how are we going to fix it? How can we reduce or eliminate this stress? It's very, very mechanically looking at it, very engineer approach. Okay, what's the problem here? And realistically look at what is the issue. Then there's the emotion-focused, and this really has to do with changing your personal emotional reaction to something. And that really involves working to change how you react to something. And I watched, how many of you watch TED Talks? Any of you watch, have Netflix and watch TED Talks?
No.
If you don't, you really should start looking at that because they have some of the best talks ever on all of these issues, on relationships, on coping, and they're incredible speakers. If you get Netflix, you'll have at the bottom, when you have all those little squares up on your TV screen, at the bottom is a red one and it has a big T. And I can't remember what TED stands for, technical, educational, something, D, whatever D stands for. But they, if you have not looked at those, you're missing out on some incredible. There is something on anything you can imagine out there, and they find just superb speakers. And I saw one where they were talking about teaching children how to change their emotions, like kids that get angry, you know, and overreact to things. And they were talking about techniques of teaching them, you know, to different ways of dealing with their anger instead of just having that outburst, that you would learn to take deep breaths. You know, count to 20 and breathe very deeply, or walk out of the room instead of hitting your sister and getting angry and shouting at your parent. Walk out of the room and count to 25. And if you really want to change how you're feeling, start at 100 and count backward by 7. 7 from 100 is 93. 7 from 93. By the time you get down to 0, you will usually have forgotten whatever it was that was upsetting you and have a totally different outlook. Try that sometime. But that's the emotion-based techniques. Really look at how you can change your emotional reactions, because our emotional reactions sometimes aren't always helpful to us in coping or in dealing with stress. Then there's a category they call occupation-focused, and I think they don't mean that so literally, occupations as you and I know it. I think it has to do with developing lasting habits that generates more positive feedback. And that there's a number of things that we do that are self-defeating in ourselves. And if you learn other habits that are more positive, you can really change, make great changes in your life that way. The appraisal strategy we talked about occurs when someone modifies the way they think, or maybe even distancing themselves from the problem, and seeing humor in the situation. In fact, humor is one of the greatest coping skills of all. If you can find a way to make a situation that is stressful to you funny, you have become the master rather than the victim. And you will, in many, if you read a lot about the lives of top comedians, you'll find out that many of them had very difficult, dysfunctional family situations. And they actually developed their humor as a way, as a coping mechanism. They learned early on if they could say something or make something funny, they could survive. And not only could they, you know, survive, it got them good attention, it made them feel better physically. Humor is a wonderful coping mechanism. I know if I have something bad happen, like very scary, stressful something, and if I go and tell someone about it, you know, and relieve some of that feeling, some of that stress, if I can keep that up and keep going, by the end of the day, I can make it funny. I can tell that scary, frightening, stressful story that I had and make it funny. And when I've done that, I have full control. Humor is one of the best. How many of you are able to do that?
Yes.
I can do that.
I can do that.
And
most times.
Yeah. Well, if you can do that, if you can take, you know, go and you have a really, your boss says something really nasty to you, or, you know, you have a bad time, and you go home and tell that story and make fun of him and laugh. You've got it. I mean, you've got full control then. There's just something about humor that makes all the difference in the world. Can all of you do it? Or do some of you have trouble?
I think it depends on the impulsivity.
You think it what?
I think it depends on the level of impulsivity and at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And I don't mean not necessarily doing it at the moment, because
right.
Sometimes you can't think fact, you just don't have that ability. But if you can turn it into something funny later, you take away some of the pain from it. You take away some of the stress.
So do you have some recommendations on, if you do struggle with that, how you can kind of turn that around and get yourself to kind of motivate you to make it funny and not let it get so worked up inside you? Is there some strategies that you can use, knowing that that's the direction you need to go, but you have trouble getting there?
Well, I think the first thing you do, and I'll give you an example that happened this week. I went in. I have a conference room in my office, a suite of offices, and I raise money for medication. And I constantly think of any way in the world I can raise money. In fact, today I sold nachos to everybody in the building with money for medicine. And in my conference room, I made it into a 7-Eleven. I have most of what you can imagine in that conference room. I have junk food. I've got, if you want lunch, I've got Beanie Weenies and SpaghettiOs and soup in a box. And I have a refrigerator full of drinks and ice cream and anything you can name. I've got every junk food. I've got greeting cards, leftover ones that I had, if you need a greeting card. You name it. So I go in my conference room, and there is a woman sitting there, and she's filing her nails, which was a little unusual. And she's not saying anything, and she's just sitting there filing her nails. And I go in frequently to get the money out of the pot, because you put money in your pot when you buy something and you take out change. And I have a few people that steal from me, and I know who they are. So I try to keep my money, you know, down to a minimum. And so I go in, I'm getting the money out, and I say, "How are you doing?" I thought it's a little unusual. She's sitting there filing her nails, looking down, not looking up, and just kept on doing it. And she said, "Did you have a good weekend?" I said, "Oh, it was a little crazy. It was okay." And she just kept sitting there. And we don't have many people come sit in our conference room. And she said something else that was a little tinge of emotion in it. And I said something back to her, and she said, "Oh, I just think sometimes you don't feel appreciated." And I knew that she was trying to cope with something very painful at that moment, in that she was filing her nails as a way to try to get her emotions under control out of her area. And I knew she worked in an area that has sort of a toxic environment, as I have counseled many a person from that area. And I said, "You know, we don't feel appreciated." I said, "Often we feel that way, and sometimes we're not." And I said, she said, "You know, you work so hard, and you try to do everything right, and you work really hard," and she's really fighting her emotions as she says this. And she said, "And then people say things, 'Yeah, well, I guess you just don't feel appreciated.'" And I said, "You know something, the truth is, we can't depend on anyone else to appreciate us. And if we depend on other people's appreciation, we get in trouble. Now, let me ask you this. Do you appreciate yourself? Do you feel good about yourself?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "Well, if you feel good inside about yourself and you feel you're doing a good job, it really doesn't matter what anybody else thinks, does it? Because you know yourself better than anyone else as to whether that is true. And you could be told most anything, and it may not be true. And so you really are the one that decides that. And I said, I bet you spend a lot of your time saying bad things to yourself inside. And she looked up at me and she said, I do. I said, you say really mean and you're always doing negative talk to yourself, aren't you? And she said, yes. I said, I want you to change that today. You stop doing that today. And you start saying good things to yourself. You start saying, I like you. You're really a good person. You say this to yourself all day long. And you will see that that will make a difference, and it will. Many of us beat ourselves up all the time. Oh, I'm so dumb. Why did I do that? Well, that was a stupid thing to say, you know. And we don't give ourselves any positive feedback. And if you're saying that to yourself, your brain doesn't know the difference in you know, this is bad stuff coming down, and it responds accordingly. So one of the first things you do in trying to make that change is you stop saying negative talk to yourself. That's one of the first steps. Then this woman said to me, she said, when I made a mistake, the woman caught it and she ran to tell someone about it. And it was like she really enjoyed it, that I made a mistake. In other places, people sort of had your back, but now it's like they're always watching me to make a mistake and so they can catch me on it. And here's another thing I find helpful in coping. Quotes. If you can find a quote that fits that situation, is really helpful. And so I said to her, fret not yourself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against the workers of iniquity, for they shall be soon cut down. I've seen the evil in great power and spreading himself like a green bay tree. Yet he passed away, and lo, he could not be found. Trust in the Lord and do good, and verily thou shalt be fed. And this woman really responded to that and asked me, could I get, I said it's from the Bible and I can't tell you which psalm, something, I can't remember which one. But, you know, all of us have had situations where we feel somebody really is trying to hurt us. And that quote, for me, really works. Fret not thyself because of the evildoers. Oh, that's a good one. You know?
Yep.
How many of you use quotes like that?
I do.
Okay. Speak the truth even though your voice trembles. That's a good one. Tell me your quotes. Anybody here have a quote?
Before it's your favorite place, it's a place you've never been. Meaning like, venture out. You might be scared, but you don't always have to be because it ends up being, you know, like next week and it's my fifth year, but I was really scared, but now it's just home.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I like that one a lot.
Yeah, that's perfect. I have a whole collection of quotes, and before I die, I hope to get, I'm going to publish them and give them to my friends. And I'm going to call it Quotes to Get You Through the Night. Because one of my coping mechanisms, if I'm upset or stressed or whatever, I can pick up my book, and I've got them all handwritten, and go through those quotes that mean a lot to me. And it just changes everything. And one of the things that I think is helpful, and you can try it if this works for you, is to make a collection of your best quotes of what things are meaningful to you that help you. And I think that's for me. And the thing about coping mechanisms is they're different for everyone, and not what works for one person won't work for the other person. or won't be as helpful as the other person. And I think men have different coping mechanisms than women a lot of times. I think there's gender differences. I know they've looked at that and studied that somewhat. And some of the emotion-focused strategies, you know, include things like meditation. How many of you meditate?
As much as possible.
Yes.
Do you find it helpful?
Yes, I do. I often hit Proverbs. Like today's the 23rd, so I'll read Proverbs 23, and I'll meditate on that one verse, and it'll carry me through the day.
Mm-hmm. So that's a really helpful thing to do, too. It, you know, meditation, and I'm planning to take there's someone that really teaches that, that I heard was really, really good, and I'm planning to take that because everyone that I know that learns to meditate finds, it tells me that they find it to be incredibly helpful. Another one is coping mechanism is progressive relaxation, where you start at the top of your head or start to, and work down relaxing all of your muscles. And this takes a bit of work to get good at that. There is a book, a really old book called You Must Relax, that I know some of our doctors recommend for patients who have migraine. And as progressive relaxation is really good for people who have migraine headaches. Some of the, you know, other coping mechanisms, one is just simply accepting responsibility or blame. Sometimes things happen and we are at fault, and yet we avoid this or we don't accept responsibility for it. And it can be really empowering just to say, hey, I apologize, that was my problem. I'm responsible for that. And for some reason, people have trouble doing this. They have trouble saying that they're to blame. They will lie or make excuses or dance around it. And sometimes the most helpful thing you can do, and it's a shocker to other people sometimes, is someone just simply says, look, that's my fault. I know a few years ago there was a situation I was in where everybody was very upset, and the guy showed up who was head of maintenance, and he said, whatever it is, I take full responsibility. And, you know, it just completely, everybody's stress level went completely down. Just him saying that, it was hilarious to watch. He just said, I'm here and I take complete responsibility, whatever it is. And it sort of ended all the hostility. It was amazing. Anybody ever done that before?
No,
most of us have a hard time with that, from what I've seen.
I don't. Ever since I'm in recovery, I don't have a problem with that.
You learned that. See, that's one of the first things you learned in recovery, wasn't it?
Yes.
What else?
94. Yeah. You know, because I have an epilepsy problem and a couple of brain tumors, and you know, I was using alcohol, you know, as a coping mechanism, and that's not good. First of all, if you have epilepsy, it's not good.
Not good at all.
No. So, you know, I finally got myself into the 12-step program, and it really helped to, you know, point the finger at me and take a look at me instead of pointing my finger at other people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's that saying, you throw the stone at the glass house, but... You know, when the stone comes back at you, you're going to crumble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. What else did you find very helpful in those 12 steps?
I found number four, make amends to the people I have harmed.
Mm-hmm.
Which also is number eight, you know, you don't want to hurt, you know, like, I'm making amends with my father. He's 85, but he's got a pacemaker and two stents, so I don't want to kill the man, you know, but I am making amends, you know,
mm-hmm.
Gently, you know, gently.
Mm-hmm.
And he's accepting it. You know, like 30 years ago, he would have never accepted it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he's accepting it now.
It's very freeing, isn't it, when you do that?
Yes, it is. It is. But I also, yeah. In the letter, I also said, you know, I'm forgiving myself. You know, I have to forgive myself.
Mm-hmm. You have to do that first, don't you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to first figure out what I did, and then I have to first admit, then I have to admit what I did, you know, and give myself self-love, like you said in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that lady in the conference room.
Yeah. Now, it was, she was so in need of someone to talk to, so in need of getting those emotions out. Yet, and she was doing everything in her power not to cry, and because people come in and out of my conference room, it was an awkward situation and wasn't going to be helpful to her if she did break down and start sobbing, and everybody wanted to know what's going. You know, it wasn't going to be helpful. So I was trying to help her get some of it out without losing total control. And I told her, I said, any other time I would tell you to go, to go somewhere and just sob and sob and sob and get it out. And it's such a relieving thing. One of the coping processes, as Gil said, God gave all of us is the ability to cry. And crying really releases a lot of emotions and cleanses the soul. I mean, thank goodness that we can cry. And, you know, when we're really hurt, and that's a great coping mechanism to relieve a lot of pain and stress. but, you know, she no one had ever said anything like this to her. She never had anyone talk to her and to say, look, you don't, you know, appreciate yourself. She had come from a background, a very dysfunctional background, where she was taught that she was no good, she was worth nothing. And then, you know, in the work situation, so when somebody says something, it means even more than it would have to me, who had a good, positive, you know, childhood and people that loved me. And that we all come into it with different backgrounds, and therefore have different abilities just coming into it in skills and coping. And if you haven't had that kind of, you know, have had a dysfunctional kind of background, it makes it harder for you. It makes it, you know, you haven't had access to a lot of healthy skills and how people should act. And that makes a big difference. But just social coping, and one of the biggest ways is seeking social support from others and reaching out to other people, healthy people. And you just shared with us, you realized at some point that you had a very maladaptive coping situation going on, and you did the healthy thing. You acknowledged mm-hmm. you had the problem. You reached out to a group that could help you.
Right.
And one of the first things I think in coping is to find a good social support somewhere. And it may be in your family, it may not be. You may have to reach out. And if you realize that you are in an unhealthy situation, whatever that is, at work or in your marriage or in your family, you have got to find a healthy outlet, and go from there. You've got to find, you know, better don't surround yourself with people who are constantly tearing you down and making you feel bad and bad about yourself, bad about everything. It's not healthy. And in regard to marital relationships, that is hard and it takes a lot of work. And I saw a beautiful article somewhere. I wish I could share. I'll find it and send it to Dina. Maybe, Dina, you can share it with everyone. But it was really talking about what you want in life and trying to figure that out and how to work toward that in a healthy way. And it was excellent. I'll send it to you, Dina, and you can share it with other people. First and foremost, one of the essential ingredients of good coping is to have adequate nutrition, exercise, and good sleep, and physical fitness. This is where if you don't have good nutrition and good sleep habits and don't exercise, your coping skills are going to be less and your stress levels are going to be higher. And I was just amazed to see, actually on a TED Talk, and then a week later we had a physician speak on this at Grand Rounds, that these new findings that they have found about sleep. We knew that sleep was important, but we didn't know exactly why. And they've just recently found that our brain, you know, our body is constantly having blood run through and picking up toxins in our body and excreting them out, and that is crucial to your health, that be done. And they never could figure out, well, what happens in the brain, because there's this blood-brain barrier, and we don't have that same kind of system, we thought, in the brain. And they just recently have found that the brain, during sleep, that there is this fluid that comes up in the brain and washes over the brain and picks up the toxins in the brain and eliminates them through the spinal column. And they had no idea about this system before. And it is crucial that this be done, and you've got to have enough sleep every night for it to work. And that's why people, you know, they say if you don't sleep, you will die, and you will. And the reason is you have this buildup of toxins, and they're now questioning what role this, you know, so many people are sleep deprived, and what role is that playing in the development of things like Alzheimer's, that where these toxins don't get out of the brain and we are forming these plaques. And perhaps it is because of these, you know, one of the ways this could happen is that people are not getting enough sleep, so that their brain isn't able to eliminate all these toxins out of the brain, which is fascinating. Mm. And, you know, I can tell you that when I've had adequate sleep, I am much better equipped to cope with anything. And if I haven't had, my coping mechanisms are not the same. How many of you have found the same?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think it's really important that we eat well, we exercise, and we get plenty of sleep. I think that is real important. Another coping skill that a lot of people are using, you may have heard something about mindfulness training.
Yes.
How many of you have had any of that?
I have.
And did you find it helpful?
Yes. I had two classes with my psychotherapist that we would meet. Probably about maybe six of us once a week.
Can you tell me?
And then, what you would do is just be very aware of your surroundings, whether it's just a dot on the wall. You could be watching TV, but there might be a dot on the white wall behind there. You know, just be aware of the blue light above the mic, even though the clock might say 8:41, but be aware that, 8:41, the numbers are in green. You know, they're just not numbers, but they're green numbers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
Yeah,
and then we would keep notes. We'd keep notes, and then, you know, the following week we would go in and, you know, we'd do more and more, and then you'd be much more aware each week, and then you'd be very aware of your surroundings. Be in the moment. Then you're really in the moment.
Because, you know, most of us are in our head all the time, and we are not mindful. We are thinking of what happened. We're thinking what's going to happen. We think about what they said back then. We're constantly going over things, and we absolutely miss our whole surroundings much of the time. And this is actually based on spiritual training, way, way, way back there, and it's based on non-judging, non-striving, acceptance, letting go. Patience, trust, acceptance, non-centering, you know. And they have found that people that have had this training that really make an incredible difference in their life and their ability to cope with things. And they're starting to use this more and more in all sorts of ways. They're teaching it in schools. They're teaching it in any number of places, and even some companies are starting to bring in classes to their employees, because they find that they just have a much greater sense of emotional balance and well-being after having these classes and engaging in this. And it really prevents you from being self-critical and ruminating about the past or worrying about the future, and which is mostly what we do. I don't know about you guys, but I'm really in my mind a lot, and I could be totally unaware of the world around me. I am so much in my mind sometimes, and I have to tell you that from time to time, when my sister comes to help me at work, she will walk in the room. Now, she is very quiet. Come up to me. I'll be on the computer thinking about 10,000 things, working on something. She will enter my room and has to walk all the way across my room around, and will come behind me and start doing something with my hair. And I will not know it, but I'll every now and then feel something in my hair, and I'll reach up, you know, and touch my hair. She has thrown spit wads at me. She has done, I can't tell you the things she's done to me. And, of course, the woman that works with me gets so tickled she can't stand it because she watches it, and I am totally not there. And so I'm one of those that needs mindfulness training. Another thing that a lot of people use in coping is music. They use music to reduce stress or to get outside themselves. How many of you use music? Anyone?
Oh, yeah, all the time, all the time.
What kind of music do you use?
Depends on what's going on. If my son Alex is having a seizure, I'll either play some classical or some, alternative jazz. For some reason, that just really smooths me out. If I'm in a melancholy mood, then I can put on some Stan Kenton or just some kind of mood music, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Depends. But if it's everyday thinking, it's gospel. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of people use music, and they feel, in the research they find that classical music is one of the best. And the worst is heavy metal. Anything that's real screechy or loud is usually not helpful. It heightens anxiety or heightens anger. But anything that is melodic and jazz would be an example, classical music, it can really change moods. And has reduced depression and anxiety, depending on the music. And a lot of hospitals have what they call music therapy programs that are used a lot. They've even, I saw something recently where they're starting to use music in surgery.
Mm.
And they find that people in pain or people that are in very anxiety-provoking situations in medicine, that music can often help that greatly. In fact, there was a story on our website, our internal website recently. There was a child that was undergoing a painful, I can't remember, they're trying to draw blood from her and they were having difficulty. And one of the little new residents, first-year resident, pediatric resident, started singing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And the child became completely quiet and quit struggling. And that sweet little resident sang that song, and everybody in the room was amazed that Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star made all the difference in the world.
Ooh.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
And we have another guy that he's an orderly and has an incredible voice. And he will sing gospel songs sometimes when he goes into the room with some of the people that are really in bad shape. And everybody begs for him to come back. Because there's something about his voice that is so calming and so soothing, and it makes such a difference for them. The same thing, art is often a good way that people relieve stress or relieve emotions. And we actually have a art therapy classes that we do with our patients with epilepsy in Winston-Salem, and I had one in Charlotte, getting ready to have another one in another part of the state. But everyone that participated in this said it just really helped them a lot in many ways with expressing their emotions. So there's...
I was going to say, you know what, that I know it's going to sound a little bit off color, but for those who know me, can pretty much testify to this. But there's times when I've had bad experiences with my health or my family's health, and the thing that works the most for me is going to a hockey game.
Well, that actually is, there's such a thing as movie therapy. Have you heard of that one? A lot of that's the same thing. It would be hockey therapy. Anything that distracts you, if you've got a lot on your mind and you are hurting or you are stressed out or you are worn, there is nothing like going and doing something that takes you into a different world.
Right.
And for a lot of people, that's movies. Going to a movie, and I can get complete. I can be just so frustrated and go to see a good movie, and I completely lose myself, and I come out and I've forgotten whatever it was I was worried about. Totally, and changing the scenery makes a big difference too.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Going for a walk in the woods is another thing that has been, there's a lot of research is showing how important it is that we go into the woods from whence we evolved. And they have, there's a new term for it. I can't remember what it is, but there's a new term for it. They are finding that there's something about being in the woods that is really, really helpful to human beings. And it's the greening, I can't remember, there's a term, and they're really starting to do more research, you know, because so many of us live in areas where it's high noise pollution, it's concrete, it's not much green, and they have found that it makes all the difference in changing us chemically, physically, all sorts of ways if we go take long walks in the woods. And
I find writing I've been writing since the age of 9, but at that time I didn't know I had tuberous sclerosis or brain tumor or epilepsy, you know. But writing really helps me just get all the everything out. It's just very, very therapeutic, you know. Right. At a time, I was even keeping track of my dreams at a time. But the last 3 years, I must say, I haven't really written them down. I got so much other stuff happening that... But even writing the dreams down when I would go to sleep and wake up in the morning,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would write what was going on, you know, when I was unconscious, you know, and that was very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Dreams, I think, are really important, and I think dreams tell us a lot about ourselves. I think that there some dreams are just mean nothing, and I think other dreams really do have meaning. And I think if you pay attention to your dreams, you lots of times can tell what's going on with yourself.
Mm.
And it's very helpful to write them down and look at the themes that you get in dreams.
Mm.
There was a quote in a book some time ago, dream maker, really, really rakes. She always gives more than she takes.
Oh, how lovely.
It was a book that talked about the importance of dreams and what they do for us and how much wisdom and knowledge is in there that they're trying to impart to us as to what we dream. And it's not always, you know, it's a lot of times it's not real clear. And everybody's dreams, different symbols mean different things to different people.
Right, it's not as lucid. Some dreams are more clearer.
It's not literal. It's not literal, the dream.
Mm.
But if you pay attention to the feeling of the dream, that's what's important. What was the underlying feeling of the dream? But writing is a beautiful way to release emotions, and you can learn a lot about yourself by just doing free-flowing writing about your feelings.
Mm. They all think I'm crazy, my family. They all got tuberous sclerosis, but they're all in denial, you know. So I'm the only one dealing with it for 22 years.
It's
on my father's side of the family. Ah, well, they are with fatty tumors. I said, Dad, but I got two in my head. I got one in my breast. I got one in my lung. I got, I got one in my knee taken out. They're just fatty tumors. You know, they're in denial. The older brother's got a tumor in his lung. The younger brother's got a tumor in the back of his neck. But, you know, they're all, you know, I'm the crazy one.
Mm-hmm. So they don't accept that they have this?
No. But the older brother, I believe he does. I put him on the mailing list and, he gets the, he's not on the phone call tonight, but he's got the email of, down there in, where Dina is.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it was Robert Shuler when I first got diagnosed in 95. I didn't know how to get in contact with tuberous sclerosis. So I was watching Robert Shuler, mm-hmm. Crystal Cathedral guy. God rest his soul right now. But anyway, he had mentioned the tuberous sclerosis and gave the telephone number. And that's how I got contact with the organization down there in Maryland.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Isn't that strange, huh? God works in mysterious ways.
You know, it is truly amazing how things happen sometimes and the people you encounter.
Yeah.
Someone said there's no chance encounters.
No.
And, one of the things I wanted to point out in terms of coping is, for everything we do that we fail at, we learn something from it. We learn incredible gifts from everything that we try and it doesn't work. And instead of beating yourself up, you just say, I learned some things from that. I learned what not to do, And it's just amazing, people that are afraid to try anything, try it. Try as many things as you can, explore new things. So you fail at it, whoop-de-doo. You learn something. Everything mm-hmm. you fail at, you learn something. It's mm-hmm. so important.
I don't want to wrap it up, but we're going to have...
So it's that time.
I just want to say, Patricia, I hope you get that book written with all your little quotes.
I really am planning to do that, and I want to give it to... I'll give it to anyone that wants it, and I'm going to publish it and make a bunch of books and just give it to anyone, because I find that it's been so helpful to me, and I just want to share them.
Well,
you're
you.
A blessing. Thank you for sharing.
So are you.
Now,
thank you.
Last, the Netflix show is TED Talks, T-E-D Talks, and that's Technical Entertainment and Design. And
okay, thank you. Entertainment,
ahead.
I thought it was education. I strongly recommend you look at those talks. They have some of the most incredible talks ever on that by really good speakers.
Awesome.
And it's a great learning.
Awesome. Thank you so much for everything you've talked about tonight, and hopefully everybody got something out of it and uses some of these techniques. Go to the TS Alliance website also if you have any questions or anything like that. Regional conferences are coming up this year, Houston, Washington, D.C., and there's one more at the end of the year, but it's not posted on there yet, so we'll wait for that one to get posted. And if that's it, I think we're good. Thank you so much, Ms. Gibson.
Thank you. Thank you for what you guys do. You're wonderful.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye, dear. I pray for you, your son, and your wife. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye-bye, dear.
Bye-bye.
Bye.